This is Unicopia Green Radio with your host, Farron Dancer.
Welcome to Unicopia Green Radio. This is your host, Farron Dancer. And you know, we're here every Saturday on Unicopia Green Radio on KTRC 1260. And we're also simulcast on SantaFe.com. So if you're not near an AM radio, pull up your laptop and go to www.santafe.com. And our show is simulcast every Saturday at 4 p.m. Unicopia Green Radio is brought to you each and every week by Unicopia, a public benefit nonprofit organization that is dedicated to the awareness, knowledge, and synergy that is key to our sustainable future. And, you know, we also like to talk about sustainable thought, and that is staying positive, being grateful, looking around, breathing in the day, and radiating the vibration that will create the future that we want to live together. And it's all about us, you know. You know, there's a lot of problems in our world, a lot of things that, you know, we feel compelled to push back against. And for good reason, there's some ugliness in the world, too. But there's so much beauty. And one of the things we'll talk about today is that beauty when it comes to nature and gardening and growing things and working not only with the earth and the physical aspects of things, but also the ethereal realms and the spiritual aspects of things and how they kind of meld together. And in keeping with that, my guest today is Maggie Lee. Maggie is a garden designer, writer, and educator, and somewhat of an expert, I believe, in the world of biodynamics. So welcome to the studio, Maggie.
Thank you, Farron. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Biodynamics, I mean, I had a little bit of experience, as I mentioned to you, Maggie, back in the 70s when I was living in Northern California, in this little town that was kind of an international hub. So all of these kind of very creative people had traveled this circuit from Kathmandu to this little town of Bolinas in Northern California. And so we got, even though we were sort of a homogeneous little community of about 1,200 people, we got exposed to some really profound worldly endeavors, including biodynamic gardening. Got introduced in the 70s to Rudolf Steiner. We did community gardens based on some of those approaches. And I can still remember the sunflowers that were like 10 feet tall with, you know, just these massive things. You know, not to mention some of the very tasty cash crops that were going on in those days, but I won't get into too many details with that. But the gardening techniques proved to be so incredibly prolific in terms of producing not only, you know, really healthy, vital vegetables and flowers and plants, but also ones that were just brimming with nutrition and flavor, which is what I remember about it, too. I'm still trying to recapture some of that essence that we experienced from the community gardens back in those days. So this, for me, is sort of an update on, you know, here like...
A revisiting
some 35 years later of some of what I experienced back in those days. So can you just, as an introduction, tell the listeners what got you involved in this realm, a little bit of your background, and what evolved your passion in this way?
Well, in the 70s, I was in Santa Monica in California, and I had gone to Finhorn. I was living in Malibu in Santa Monica area, and I had gone to this community called Finhorn in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it was my first introduction to world community. And it was a great experience, as you say, of a lot of people from all over the world noticing that something was happening. And after I came, I got introduced, of course, to some of the gardening practices there, which I wouldn't say were biodynamic particularly, but they were having amazing results because of their relationship to the spirits. These, what I had mentioned briefly to you before, the undines and sylves, and they cultivated that relationship, which seemed to do something for their garden. And when I came back from there, I was Working as a writer and a coordinator for festivals for something called the International Cooperation Council. And at one of the festivals, I met a man named Steve Spangler, who at the time has had an exotic seed company and tropical nursery in the West Los Angeles area. And as we began to talk, we became friends, and I started to work with Steve, who was a biodynamic gardener. And he would go to Hawaii every year to all the islands back in the 70s to do collection, knew fantastic people there out of his going there year after year.
Mm-hmm.
And had introduced me to some of those principles and what was called anthroposophy, which is where biodynamics comes from. Steiner developed spiritual science or anthroposophy in the 20s and 30s.
Just to back up a minute, you know, just the Findhorn model, and some of the listeners may be familiar with it, but I recall in those days, it was the rage when you read about what was going on in Findhorn, and they had, you know,
gigantic cabbages
and watermelons that, you know, you needed a forklift to, you know, get out of the garden. But
big isn't always better.
Big is not always better, but things grew so prolifically.
Right.
And from my understanding, it was not, I mean, obviously there was some physical science involved in the gardening techniques, but there was something energetically in that place that was filled with spirit divas or whatever. You know, I can't remember how they broke it down exactly, but it was almost magical.
And I think that's a good word for it because I think all throughout Europe, as you know, there's a lot of sacred sites and mm-hmm. rock monoliths and such, and this there must have been something in this property as well that made it special. And they cultivated this relationship with the unseen forces, as I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and somehow that seemed to translate into what they were able to move out of the garden, you know, grow in the garden.
And that just that mention of unseen forces, and I just want to throw this out there because it applies to Findhorn and applies to gardening and working with nature and growing things, but it also applies to all the energetics of life on the planet. And there are unseen forces that if we are attuned and we know how to tap them somehow, they can be supportive in our needs, wants, and desires as well, in creating whatever it is we want to create. So that's sort of the unseen world that, you know, if we align with it correctly. And in the case of the biodynamics and the gardening world,
it's a big part of it.
It's a big part of it.
And again, it's about positive life force.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get going a bit, I'm hoping to have the opportunity to discuss with you a bit more description of what those forces are, so they are not that to engage people's curiosity.
Well, since we're here right now at that point, can you explain those forces a little bit? Give it a little more definition for the listeners.
I wanted to talk about them in context to the biodynamic preparations.
There are
four principles inherent to biodynamic gardening and farming, and I will try and talk about these forces initially, and
okay.
then we can back up a bit if that's the way you would like
okay,
to
so
go.
Okay, so you want to just start in with the first one of those forces?
Sure, I can. I did want to, by way of introduction, however, if this is all right with you, I wanted to give a little bit of sense of how, from where we come, with a history of indigenous peoples, that the biodynamic way of looking things is consistent with this native wisdom narrative. So
let's talk about the native wisdom and why it is that indigenous peoples were tapped into that energy, and maybe even how it got kind of lost along the way. But that might be a conversation for another day. I don't know.
Well, in my sensibility, life comes from life. Beautiful, alive, and thriving. The Native Americans and indigenous peoples everywhere seem to demonstrate in their understanding with heightened awareness of this life comes from life. They had an empathetic experience with the earth as a benevolent place, a living planet embodied by a wisdom goddess. And this wasn't an intellectual exercise. It was rather a dynamic, interactive, sensual experience.
Those are my favorite kind, but go ahead.
And it was built on a foundation of trust and honor and truth, evident in their choices to protect the earth while appreciating its beauties and bounties. This element of honor, I think, is really prominent in what we know of the American Indian history. But I mean, indigenous peoples in general really
know
this.
Yeah, you can go across the planet and see that same approach or mindset with the connection to nature.
And I, we have a bit, I would say in our contemporary world, there's amnesia going on. Mm-hmm. There's a forgetting of this. And I would take this one step further and say that there is a reciprocal and rejuvenating connection bonding human nature to Gaian nurture. Gaia is my word for
human
Mother
nature
Earth,
to
Earth.
Gaian nurture. Can you kind of just define Gaian nurture a little bit?
Gaia is a Greek word for Earth. Mm-hmm. And in the work of Lynn Margulis and James Lovelock and the Gaia Hypothesis, I won't necessarily go into the details of that, but the understanding in science and biology of the Earth as a holistic system, as a living planet, mm-hmm. is becoming more widespread knowledge.
We were talking a little bit about your history, and I know you ended up traveling to the Hawaiian Islands, and you got a bit of an introduction to the world of the energies. And I know I've spent a lot of time in the islands myself, and there's such a profound sense of creation that goes on there. You know, not to mention standing on the cliff and watching lava shooting onto the lava tube and hitting the ocean and creating more island, right as you're standing there with hot tennis shoes. So, but beyond that, there's an incredible sense of creation when it comes to living things.
And prolific. Yeah.
Prolific. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about your experience there.
Well, I was very fortunate in working with Steve Spangler, who had such an intense background, because it not only taught me a lot about how things grow and being able as a burgeoning designer to experience things in situ and see the counterpoints and harmonies and tensions that were created with the way things grow in nature. And Hawaii, what a place to be able to see that, because there's so much variety, so much incredible fragrance, so much delicious fruit. And so we would do a lot of collection. We would actually ferment them a bit in buckets and then put them on the seeds on screens, dry them while we went diving. And so it was a very worthwhile experience. I started to then work with Steve in his business and find out more specifically about biodynamics, about biodynamic growing and compost making in his nursery. And
what island was that, by the way?
We went to all of them.
Oh, okay.
I even went to, what's the one island where the lepers are?
I've forgotten. Lanai?
Yeah. So we went all over, and that was through many years. And then I met a man named John Lash, who I had decided to move to Santa Fe from the Santa Monica area to study with. I moved here in 1981 with a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction and took a course with many others on contemporary human physics, and was a florist for many years here, and then in the 90s started production of biodynamic compost and started my design business. I wanted to just have a sentence or two to revisit what I was speaking of with regards human nature to Gaian nurture, and that her well-being is our well-being. There's not a lot of separation from that.
You know, and interestingly, in this time and space, with the energies that are kind of messing with the planet and the environment, there's a disconnect, and we see this prolifically in terms of sort of that whole manifest destiny mindset that arrived here with the Europeans back hundreds of years ago. And that is the disconnect. It's like oh, well, we can just go ahead and do whatever to the planet, and we're kind of separate from that as long as we're making money or something. And the irony or the truth that goes with that is that we're all one. We're all one with the planet. Energetically, you can't really separate it out. And so until the consciousness shifts to a grander perspective or a broader perspective of that awareness, we're in for a little bit of a struggle in terms of the abuse that's going on in terms of Mother Nature and the planet itself.
She's had to absorb a great deal. What's that word when you are needing to do several things at once?
Multitask.
Can you imagine how much multitasking Gaia does? And she does an amazing job. But I think that we're at the knife's edge. It has become valuable and profitable to pollute. And the whole power block that would, if I could take it as far as that, that want World War III out of the greed and power struggle.
Uh-huh.
That's a whole other subject that's pretty dangerous.
So it's dangerous. You know, and I'm thinking about us as individuals, our own bodies, and how much resiliency we have in terms of dealing with pollutants and the abuses that we lay on it, or, you know, life lays on it. And yet, at some point, if you go too far and you tox it out too badly, then the body breaks down, shuts down, checks out, whatever. And again, we're an integral part of this greater life essence that you have brought to our attention. And so it's similar with the planet. It's resilient to a point.
Yeah.
And then it would start to break down. Although I believe that Mother Nature gets the last laugh, because the powers that be, in terms of the bigger picture,
Small time. But they're very dangerous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we see that in the rise of social, the predators.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Farron, that's a pretty big subject to tackle here. So
we're not going to tackle it.
No,
we're just
going to
touch on it.
Yeah. So I wanted to say, again, her well-being is our well-being. And biodynamics is consistent with what I've mentioned briefly in this narrative, in this native wisdom narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It's best not to isolate our Earth from the biosphere that nourishes and sustains us. And I think that's part of the key. You know, it's an extension of animism in some ways to really realize in experience and deep feeling and awe that the connection there. And I wanted to say then that the real wealth of nations is in our soils. This naturally includes water and atmosphere. And a primary focus in biodynamic agriculture is to create a living atmosphere in the soil, positive life force. And if...
So good idea to take care of the soils, and we know that...
They are what nourish us.
There's a number of movements afoot, and obviously biodynamics is one of these principal players in reestablishing the right chemistry to our soils and introducing the right elements and keeping it vital and alive. And because we've got a lot of depleted soils around the planet right now, chemical fertilizers, pesticides,
yeah,
monocrops, all of that. So this is a very hands-on approach you're talking about right here. And it's about being conscious not only of the techniques involved, but the energetics involved. And that, I think that's the biggest message we want to impart here, that holistic perspective on working with nature and being an integral part of that process.
Yeah, I think that it's an interactive experience. And it's not that biodynamics is that much different than in outlook or philosophy than organic gardening or permaculture. It just takes it one step further as far as its concentration on these life forces. And next we could maybe talk about the four principles of biodynamics.
Well, let's introduce those in the next segment, because we're winding down here right now in this segment. But I just love this little quote I have from you: life comes from life. And, it's interesting. what that reminds me of is like you have a little puddle that forms and along comes a tadpole. So that idea exists in nature. We'll be right back here on Unicopia Green Radio in just a moment.
So when you're riding through the ruts, don't you complicate your mind. So when you're riding through the ruts.
Welcome back. This is Farron Dancer here on Unicopia Green Radio. And I'm here in the studio with Maggie Lee, garden designer, writer, and educator, and expert in the world of biodynamic gardening. And I just want to remind the viewers to pick up a copy of the Green Fire Times. Green Fire Times is located on newsstands throughout northern New Mexico, and it's all about things that are sustainable and renewable and about our environment and about our consciousness and the evolution that is transpiring within our culture that's going to get us to that sustainable future that we're looking for. My column in Green Fire Times this month is about our clean air and our cheap energy that we have here in Santa Fe, and it comes at a cost. And I want you, the readers, to tune in and take a look at where our energy comes from and the effects on the Navajo Nation, because we're essentially powered up by coal. And even though we breathe clean air here, it's affecting others in other places. So pick up a copy of the Green Fire Times. Welcome back, Maggie.
You
know, before the break, we were kind of running down, building up towards the four principles of biodynamics. And why don't you just lead in and get us going with those four principles?
Super. I've adapted the this, I think, what's quite direct and fairly easily to understand from a YouTube video from Alan York, who's an international biodynamic consultant. He's been in it a long, long time. And he recently developed the property of Trudy Styler and Sting's property, 900-acre estate outside Florence into
Sting, a.k.a. the police sting? Okay, cool.
Totally. Outside Florence into biodynamic vineyards. He's worked in Chile, I mean, all over, and he's extremely knowledgeable. And this is what he relates in his story of four principles of biodynamics. The first principle is dedicated to creating, as close as possible, a closed system with regards to nutrients, organizing the natural resource base so that it supports the property. This can be accomplished in a few ways: by composting all organic matter, by managing and recycling water to stay within the site, by preserving riparian areas, by being attentive to the waste stream and creating a system to capture that stream and turn it into a fertility stream. Here we're talking about livestock waste. He gives a couple of examples I thought were useful. Because he deals often in vineyards, he says with grapes, for instance, the focus is on quality. There's not necessarily a large yield, so as the yields drop, so do the nutrient levels drop in proportion. And he says further, there's about 3 tons to an acre, not large losses. But then he draws another comparison. With bananas, however, there is 20 tons to an acre with much larger losses, so it is more difficult to maintain with relation to nutrients this level of production with a closed system. And what that is referring to is really that at that point one needs to bring in outside or import compost, manure, etc. So that was where he was saying as much as possible. The second principle concerns landscape ecology and its self-regulating capacities and ability to deal with disease and pests. This can be optimized by creating biodiversity. A pond, for example, can safeguard against fire or manage runoff, but it also can bring beauty to the property while at the same time creating food, water, and shelter for biological organisms that play a role in the predator-prey relationship as predators eat eggs of other detrimental insects. In nature, we rarely find large outbreaks of pests except where there has been a disturbance. In natural ecosystems, there is usually a sufficient number of organisms working together that everything is kept in check. So this is a dynamic relationship developing, which in time eliminates the need to use insecticides. Building biodiversity in landscape ecology is a commitment in time with a long history of success.
I have a question. I'm going to pose something here. because I understand when one works very closely with the energies and the natural elements and so on, that you can create a healthy garden. You can create a garden that doesn't need pesticides or chemicals or any of that, and it resists pests because it's healthy and it's more resonant. It's more resonant energetically. How would and let me know if this is even possible, because it's one thing to grow a personal garden or even a community garden like that, but to get crops growing to feed, you know, the masses. Is there a way one could transition from the current industrial chemical approach to
monocropping and such? Yeah.
Yeah. So can this be applicable to a larger scale?
I believe so. And someone like Alan would know that well, because he works on these larger scale, often transitioning commercial grape vineyards to biodynamics. And he had mentioned in this, in that particular reference, how the using diversity is an initial way that they could do that, not so much of the monocropping, so that you are often in those situations where there's a prolonged use of chemicals, it discourages the roots from assimilating elements from the soil. So the life forces are stifled, and you get this.
And then you got to put in the chemical fertilizers.
Dependency, right.
Yeah, just to make them even grow at that point, right?
So I think it's probably, as he was saying, you know, how it's something that develops in time, that one initial way would be to introduce biodiversity. And we know what that means with regards to bees and butterflies and everything, moths and insects.
And I know from previous shows here on Unicopia Radio, we had a discussion about the bees going away as a result of the chemical pesticides and what's out there in the ecology now.
And they're stressed.
Bees are stressed. Yeah. And they're not alone. People
right.
are a little stressed too, for the most part. But it's a sign of the moving away from the natural world and the integration of all the necessary elements to this sort of, you know,
holistic system.
Yeah, from the holistic system to a profit-driven, chemical-based approach to dealing with nature.
Well, that's the key, is the profit-driven.
Profit-driven.
Yeah. And the inability to empathize.
Well, I can tell you that there's business models, and one business model is in keeping with the article I mentioned in the Green Fire Times, and that is an investor-owned utility, which is a business model throughout the country. But there's a movement away from it, and we're moving away from it, at least philosophically right now here in Santa Fe, and that is to have a community-based energy source rather than an investor-owned utility, which is not about the people. It's about profit-driven motivation. And so it applies to so many segments of our culture, and we all like making money, and it's kind of a key feature to life in the capitalistic world. But we also have to keep in mind what you're saying, Maggie, and that is this holistic.
Well, it's for the future somewhat,
yeah,
too.
Because what is sustainable?
Right.
Is sucking all of the profit out of everything you can right now based on greed is not going to create a sustainable future for us.
Well, it's not very far-reaching.
No, it's hardly far-reaching. Yeah. It's kind of instant gratification. Came with, like, TV dinners back in the 60s. I remember that.
And that's why, again, as I expressed in my introduction, taking a moment to, as many people in Santa Fe certainly do, evident by Green Fire Times and yourself, Farron, looking at the American Indian and the Native Americans and the indigenous tribes that have caretook the earth or have caretaken the earth for so long,
right,
and what that means, you know.
We
can't go back to that time, and that's not really the point. The point is to integrate it into how we go forward.
Well, and sometimes you need to look backwards in order to move forward correctly.
Well, the planets go retrograde for some reason, right?
Yes, that's right. They spin backwards every once in a while just so they can spool up and get another thrust.
Well, so we can slow down, and that's why gardening is so beautiful. I was visiting a friend who has a wonderful small place, mostly a a flower and garden, and he was rushing through cleaning up dead bits of this and that, vines and stuff. And I was talking to him about, you know, being in a garden and how it can slow you down at some times. So it just depends on your activities, of course. But generally, gardening is a very healthy activity that we share with people all over the world, even though we're doing it in our locale. And
there's something about that rich dirt under your fingernails that just puts you in touch with creation.
Yeah.
You know?
And it feels good.
It feels good.
Santa Fe's pretty challenging, as we all know. So that's why I believe our...
Not just in general. We're talking about gardening
yes,
here. Okay?
Right. No, it's challenging in gardening because of the conditions we deal with. And the compost we create, this biodynamic compost, is made with alfalfa-fed cows. And it just holds a lot of moisture. And I wanted to go on...
And that's important here especially, right?
Terribly.
Terribly
yeah.
important.
I wanted to go on to the third principle in the biodynamic in biodynamics, and that does deal with these preparations. There are two preparations that are applied as field sprays in the spring, and one is on the soil and one is on the foliage. Then there's 5.5 preps that are inserted into the body of the pile, of the compost pile, once it's built, and half of valerian, another one of the elements, is stirred in a vortex for a short time and then sprayed over the finished heap. These are humus-like solids that are specially made plant-derived substances. Rudolf Steiner designated yarrow, chamomile, stinging nettle, valerian, dandelion, and oak bark as a foundation for individual preps. Each relates to a specific nutrient element in the soil. Nitrogen, calcium, sulfur, potassium, and phosphorus. Each corresponds to a particular metabolic or growth activity of plants or mineral dynamic in the soil. Steiner related in his agricultural course that these preparations organize and vitalize the compost. They lead the fermentation of the pile in an optimizing direction with a speedy and even breakdown, so that the organic matter is more fully digested, which results in the formation of stabilized colloidal humus. Colloidal means held in suspension, storing nutrients and moisture so it lasts longer in the soil. I heard the other day that humus can last up to 40 years, and I wanted to just describe humus. It's the nutrient-rich soil component. It's the persistent residue of the biological activity from billions of microorganisms at the varying states of growth, death, and reproduction. So a little goes a long way.
So when we look in the forest, Maggie, and we see trees that are breaking down and turning into, you know, the insects are just eating away and rain is coming down, and eventually it just becomes soil, right? Mm-hmm. But it was plant matter, it was trees, it was sometimes even animal matter, and it all just gets broken down and eventually, is that sort of a natural humus that occurs in the forest?
I believe so, yeah. And through the process, it I think becomes a high quality, if we look in the health in the forest, it becomes this high quality humus that can last for a long time because of this slow breakdown.
And then that's where we see those mushrooms just like to take off out of that.
Mycelia, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and then moving on to this fourth principle, as a holistic system is attentive to the interaction of all living things in dynamic relationship, which is really just what Farron said. We are not directly doing anything to one specific thing, rather managing the environment to ensure the maximum benefit to all living organisms for a healthy, thriving environment. The opposite of this, briefly, as we know, is the atomistic worldview of materialistic science. There is a world built from single entities called atoms, which combine to make molecules, which combine to make matter. This system is non-living and doesn't bring forth life. Tractors can't bear baby tractors.
I've noticed that. I mean, that would be a hell of a business, wouldn't it?
So those are the four principles. I think that Alan laid them out fairly directly. And what I would like to do now, Farron, if you'll allow me, is to talk a little about what are these unseen forces, so they're not so vague and abstract, as my sister would say.
Please do. Let's give some. Let's give a little form to the unseen.
Okay, here we go. I wanted to draw attention to the unique quality of preparations, and this may require listeners to be a little bit more open-minded and engage their curiosity. And I think I'll start with the Hopi Kachinas, something that most people in our area might be familiar with. I had fortune of visiting, I know we're a little short on time, so I won't go too much into story, but I had fortune of visiting before I moved to Santa Fe in the 70s to visit the Hopi dances and go to the mud dance, the snake dance, be in a kiva, eat the piki bread off of the hot stone, and be at dusk in Carolyn Tawangima's cornfields as she was singing to the corn. And part of what they were doing in these ceremonies is fostering their relationship with these unseen spirit forces. And we can see that also reflected in the European words of sylphs, undines, and salamanders, as we were talking briefly about at Finhorn. So Steiner designated these forces to be called the etheric. And they are what we find in principle in the preparations. So these forces, they model and form substance. When we are born, they are the architect of the physical body, completely involved in building it. They lend a shaping gesture to germination, growth, development, and reproduction.
Would our own DNA, you think, be sort of like a similar thing here, whereby within the DNA is the molecular structure of what comes out?
Yes, I would think so.
Kind of similar.
I would think so. And
without, you know, high-powered microscopes, DNA would certainly be the invisible world as far as people are concerned, mm-hmm. right? So there's almost a menu that's
exactly
that's there.
An architect. There was diverge too much, but a wonderful book out of the 60s called Sensitive Chaos by Theodore Schwenk with a preface by Jacques Cousteau was the first book on water phenomenology. And what he was trying to show in that was how the meteorological atmospheric conditions that we find around the planet Earth are ultimately the same forms that go to form that are the same forces that go to form our organs, these much larger, maybe etheric forces. So I wanted to just say that we experience these phenomena like electricity, gravitation, magnetism by their effects, which is similar with the biodynamic preparations. If we take iron fillings on a sheet of paper and hold a magnet on top, the arrangement of the filings form an image of the magnetic field. So this is very similar to what we're trying to build a picture of here, that the preparations are carriers of forces rather than substances. It's a dynamic rather than the physical property of the preps that we're looking at here. By their nature, they're immaterial and can't easily be weighed and measured. So I would say one further thing, that therefore etheric forces need a material medium, which is what is most prevalent on our planet, which is water as a rhythmic carrier of life.
Right. So, and we've seen this repeatedly. You know, I'll just bring up the example in that movie, What the Bleep, the Komodo.
Emoto.
He was the scientist that did that study on water and how emotions, be it love or anger or hate or whatever, it could actually be seen in crystallized formations within the water itself.
Well, water is laminar, and that's one of the things that allows it to carry information.
You know, we're winding out of time. I want you to mention your website real quickly here.
Garden Gaia, G-A-I-A, gardengaia.com.
Okay, well, Maggie, I got to say goodbye. Thank you for being here. This is Farron Dancer.
Aloha.
On Unicopia Green Radio. Aloha to you, and we'll catch you next time. Signing off.